You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Joe did have a dream that I was on the podium of the Tour de France, which, great dream.
I sent him a text the next morning.
I wish I had that dream, but yeah, only Joe.
The rest of the dream was he was on the podium, he was third, and Lavenue came up in tears and took the microphone in Paris and said, "I just wanted to make America great again."
A few years ago, we did a special episode for Friends of the Cycling Podcast about a small community of young American pro cyclists all living in Nice. They were Ian Boswell, Joe Dombrowski, and Larry Warbass. My name's Richard Moore. It's early December, and I've come back to Nice to meet up with the three of them again, as well as a couple of younger Americans, Will Barta, who's just finished his first season with CCC, and Matteo Jorgensen, who has signed for Movistar for 2020. We'll hear from those two later in this episode. But before we speak to the older Americans, we've got a quick message for you about signing up as a friend of the podcast. For that, it's over to Lionel Burney in Not Watford.
Thanks, Richard, and thank you to everyone who has signed up as a friend of the podcast over the past 5 years. Your support has played a huge part in keeping us on the road and enabling us to produce more than 150 free episodes a year. Without you, we couldn't bring you daily coverage of the three Grand Tours or our spin-off shows, the cycling podcast Feminin, Service Course and Explore. By signing up as a friend, you not only directly contribute to supporting the podcast, but you can also listen to at least 15 special episodes that we'll be releasing over the course of the year. For 2020, thanks to your support and in response to feedback from some of our friends, we've improved the way we deliver Friends of the Podcast episodes. You'll now be able to subscribe to our special episodes with just a few taps on your phone, adding the Friends feed to your favourite podcast app. We've also frozen the price for another year, so a year's subscription will cost just £15. You can't even get a cassoulet and a cappuccino for that. The only difference is that your subscription will, if you want it to, renew automatically at the end of the year, just like a subscription to Spotify or Netflix. That means there's no more faff re-adding or resubscribing to a new feed each year. Hopefully you'll find the system a lot easier to use. A subscription is £15, but you can give more if you want to, and we're very grateful to those of you who choose to. Check out thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe to find out more. We'll be inviting our best friends to guest edit a special for the final episode of the year. This year's final episode, Creating a Culture, was guest edited by friend of the podcast, William Martino. And if you do decide to give more, you'll also get a signed copy of our latest book, The Grand Tour Diaries. The first episode is called The Stage That Didn't End, featuring interviews with Tour de France champion Egan Bernal, who took the yellow jersey at the end of the now infamous unfinished Stage 19 in the Alps, and Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, who during the drama of the hailstorm and landslide had to convey the information to the race convoy that the stage was being cancelled. We'll have another couple of episodes coming out in and around the Christmas period, so if you'd like to support the Cycling Podcast and listen to all our special episodes, go to thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe on your laptop, phone or tablet. All you need is your email address and a credit card, and within a few taps you'll be a friend of the podcast. It's as simple as that.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thanks, Lionel, in Not Watford for that. And a reminder from me too that if you'd like a copy of our new book, The Grand Tour Diaries, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on book. That's our diaries from the 2018 and 2019 seasons, from the Giro, the Tour, the Vuelta and the Women's Tour. And it's available at thecyclingpodcast.com. Click on book. It's still available for Christmas and we'll post it anywhere in the world. Now, with Joe Dombrowski, Larry Warbass and Ian Boswell, there was a lot to catch up on. Boswell's had a terrible year. He was riding for Katusha Alpecin and at Tirreno Adriatico in March, he crashed very heavily and suffered a serious concussion. It was the sixth concussion of his career and it effectively ended his season. Last week, Boswell was back in Nice to pack up his apartment. His career isn't exactly ending, but is entering a new phase. He's got a lot to say about what's happened to him and what the future holds, and we felt that that was deserving of a separate interview, so we'll hear more from Boswell early in the new year. Dombrowski, meanwhile, is switching teams from EF Education First to UAE Team Emirates. And Warbass can reflect on a similarly big culture change this year when he moved from the defunct Aqua Blue Sport team to the French institution that is AG2R. He'll ride for them again in 2020. They're not exactly old, these three Americans, but they're not so young anymore. And I started the interview by reminding Dombrowski about our first meeting at the Tour of Oman in 2013, when he'd just signed for Team Sky. So, guys, it was actually 3.5 years ago I was here, when you were young Americans. but you're talking now, you're talking there about, you know, the old days, like you're old guys now. It seems to have passed very quickly. I mean, it really doesn't feel very long ago that I was interviewing you, Joe, in Oman as this kind of green...
I was thinking about that.
Were you?
Yeah, just today I was thinking about that, actually.
You know, you very green kind of young guy just come over from America starting out. Has it gone as quickly for you? Not that it's at the end for you yet, but has it gone very quickly?
Yes and no. I suppose when I look back to that interview in Oman in 2013, it feels pretty quick, but... in the moment, I wouldn't say so. There's also some slow times.
And, I mean, Joe, you've got a big change next year, joining UAE Team Emirates.
Yep.
How did that come about, that move?
Well, I'd actually spoken with them in 2018, and I was sort of looking to change teams, but I was coming off a couple sort of poor seasons, and I think, understandably, from their side... there was maybe reluctance to make that investment. And I spoke with a few people I knew at the team and people that sort of suggested, you know, that, hey, this is a rider to sign. And I sort of stayed in contact with them loosely through 2019. And then I think they were like, after having a better year in 2019, they sort of thought it was a good move.
There were a few rumors of Sunweb as well were talked about for you a while ago.
I don't know where the Sunweb rumor came from.
Just come out of thin air.
I don't know. Was that you?
It wasn't me, I promise. These rumors don't do any harm, do they?
No.
I guess. But what will be your role at UAE? I mean, it's a team that seemed to take a big step forward this year.
Yeah, I think it's a team that is... really, from what I can see, there's a lot of investment in the infrastructure around the riders. I think they're becoming more like what you've seen with what Sky did. Allocating more resources and time to kind of rider support in view of performance. In terms of my specific role, I think I don't really know, to be honest. My assigned director was Alan Piper, and the coach I was assigned was Audrey van Diemen, and both of them asked me what I wanted to do, which I've not really ever heard from a team, to be honest. They sort of earmarked me for the Giro, and Audrey had mentioned that they wanted me to kind of pursue the best GC ride I can there, but I mean, beyond that, I don't know too much. I actually haven't been to a camp yet. I'm leaving on Monday, so I think I'll see a lot there. But my impression is the same as yours, that I think they're a team that's really moving in the right direction. So I'm happy to be a part of that.
And Larry, a year into your time with a French team, that was a big sort of culture shock, I guess. How's it going? How'd you reflect on it? You've got another year next year.
Yeah, definitely. So it was a huge adjustment. I think underestimated the adjustment it was going to be. So I thought it was going to be a bit easier than it was. But in the end, it worked out pretty well. So it just took me a long time to really settle in. I think part of it was just becoming comfortable speaking French, you know, because I went to this school last off season and I, you know, made it to a decent level of proficiency, but I wouldn't say like being proficient and being comfortable speaking in the language are two totally different things. So I think like it took me a couple months to really feel comfortable like speaking with my teammates and becoming like a part of the group sort of. And yeah, once that happened, like everything started to click. So yeah, it was like I'd say I had a pretty hard first half of the year, just like mentally and everything. But yeah, then actually I finished the season really strong and I had the strongest end of season I've ever had. So, if I could just like, yeah, I didn't really get any results, but just, I was the strongest at the end of the season I've ever been.
You were up there in the Italian kind of.
Yeah, I was up there, but unfortunately I didn't turn it into like a real result, which would have been nice. So yeah, I just really want to actually sort of continue on that direction. And yeah, in the end, like the team was happy, I was happy. So yeah, it was good.
And Roman Bardet is quite a near neighbor, Ian was saying. Do you see a bit of him? Do you train with him a bit?
Yeah. So he has a place in Vence, so he comes down for, like, training box. He just came down, like, the other week. We trained together a bit, came over for a Thanksgiving dinner I had. So yeah, it's cool. It's good to train with him, and, yeah, he trains hard. So it's nice to have a good training partner to push you a bit. So yeah, that's good. And I think maybe the plan is to do a bit of his schedule next year, so I'm looking forward to that.
And Ian, what's it been like for you having been out of this Nice bubble? Because I guess the thing that brought me here 3.5 years ago was this little community of American bike riders that was here and is still kind of being maintained and renewed almost. We'll talk about that in a bit, but you've had some time away from it this year. What's it been like coming back?
Well, Mr. I was going to do a Russian thing, but no. It's been, the community in Nice has definitely grown since you've come here. I think, you know, Joe and I explained 3.5 years ago how when we came here, we felt relatively isolated. And tomorrow you're going to meet with Will Bart and Matteo Jorgensen, who are both actually living in my apartment right now with me. So it's pretty crowded. But I think that, you know, the kind of the culture of Nice and cycling has definitely grown here, and it's nice to come back here and like realize that I've been away for 8 months and to come back and, you know, see so many people and kind of really continue where we've left off. But it's I guess it's sad because I'm leaving on Saturday, and there's a lot of friends I have met here and have, you know, connected with, and I know that it's going to be more difficult to stay in touch with those people down the road, and I'm, you know, hoping to come back for the tour. I don't know if we had any part in why the tour came to Nice, but you never know. I mean, I think it's been an awesome time to be in Nice, and it's, you know, it does feel like a second home. You know, my wife and I have been back here for like 2 weeks now, and there's places we go and things we do that really make it feel like a home, and I think it's a place that I'll always come back to.
I mean, I mentioned Taylor Finney as well. What and the young guys coming in now, there's this sort of, I guess, growing American presence here. What do you think when you do you sort of do you train with those guys at all? Do you hang out with them, the younger riders, and do you see through their eyes, you know, the journey that they're on as well, and does it make you feel, I don't want to say old, but, you know, like a more experienced rider?
Only Matteo makes me feel old because he calls me old sometimes, and then I'm like, what the heck, man? So the thing is we spend some time with them, but in terms of training, a lot of the young guys, they're so focused on their efforts and intervals and stuff that they ride alone most of the time. So we ask them to ride, and most of the time they just don't want to come with us. So, you know, I think, okay, at least when I was younger, I did that a bit until I realized it's important to, you know, sometimes the only social interaction you have in the day is riding with people. It's good to ride with other guys. Sometimes they push you. Sometimes they make you go longer when you wouldn't have any of that. It's also good company. So, you know, I think we found a nice balance of, like, we do our efforts, but then we ride together in between all the efforts. And, you know, it's the same for, like, a lot of guys in Monaco and everything. But, yeah, these young guys are just doing their own thing. So
I remember when I was here the last time, Adrian Costa was here, and I think he was living with Will Barta, wasn't he, at the time. And you know, at the time, he was also a younger rider and very talented, but you were worried. I remember you saying you were worried about him because that was the sort of training he was doing. It was very serious, very focused. You don't want to make too much of a correlation between that and what happened to him, but clearly he did have a burnout and he'd take time away and had this terrible accident, of course. But that's a sort of cautionary tale, isn't it, really?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's like, you know, I don't know. I have no clue. It's hard to say now, but it's like, I think I wouldn't be surprised if you see, you know, there's all these young guys who are absolutely smashing it and flying now, but like, I don't know if like the lifestyle they live is super sustainable and like long-term, because like sometimes they're so focused that it's really hard to do that like 365 for so many years, you know?
Well, I think sometimes when people talk about balance in life, that it's like, well, really, if you want to be successful at the pointy end of anything, especially on a world stage, balance is sort of, I don't really buy into that much. There are times that you need to be unbalanced and really focused. But I think that being said, in the long run, if you're going to be able to kind of maintain that very high level for a very long time, I think that's where sometimes being able to switch off is pretty important. Knowing that then there's times where you really have to turn that back on. And I don't think that's just cycling. I think that's, anything that's highly competitive requires that. So,
Ian, we were talking earlier today, and you were saying that every pro rider should take a like 6-month sabbatical from the sport, just come out of it for 6 months and come back in with a...
Well, the problem is then coming back in.
The problem is then coming back in. That is the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, Larry, Joe, and I, so Will's lived with me for, I think, 2 years now. He moved in last year, I guess, when he was on Action, then came to CCC. I, observed a lot, and for a while we had the same coach, and he took the training very literal. Like, if it was 5 hours and it was a rainy day, like, he would just jump on the trainer for 5 hours, and I would call up our coach and, like, hey, I'm going to change training because tomorrow's sunny. I'm not going to do 5 hours on the trainer. And so there was a long while where I thought of him as, like, being crazy, or like he was, we would like not pick at the younger riders, but like these guys are like way too focused. Like I said, they wouldn't train in a group. They were just doing their own training. It was extremely specific. But looking at it now, that to them, that's what cycling is now. Like that's what brings them the satisfaction of training. It's getting back and uploading their file and hitting those numbers. And I would assume, and I think it's the same for Larry and Joe. Like we enjoy the process of training and the numbers, but we just as much enjoy coming back from a good ride and socializing with people. And for us, that's kind of the world we grew up in of cycling. And it's almost this, I view it as like this transition from like this romantic side of cycling to this very, kind of numbers based form of cycling where it's changed from, being a social sport to now being a very, it's a high end sport now. It's the same as Formula One. They're not messing around. It's, if you're going to be doing the job, like Joe said, you have to be, kind of both feet in.
I remember, you went off on your famous no-go tour with Connor. It was only a week, but, it seemed to give you a fresh perspective on the sport. Was that something you were able to internalize and take forward and really try and keep that perspective to your training and the way you were thinking about your sport, or is it something that's just kind of faded into the background?
I'd like to say that I've done like the same thing. Yeah. I mean, maybe it did change my view a bit, but it didn't change like 100% how I train. I'm still super focused. Like, I mean,
you don't train with panniers now.
No. True. Although I was saying, I actually think that was like a something that we should try, because it's like something about that, we were so strong after that trip. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's something I definitely want to do again, and it's something I want to like incorporate just yearly. Unfortunately, it didn't really work out for us this year, just because of both our schedules and everything. Connor had a baby, life happens also. So it's something I think we definitely want to do again in the future. And I think to have that adventure, like even Joe, he did, he didn't race much at the end of the year, so he did like a little adventure into the mountains with his now wife. I think like doing things like that keeps it fresh, keeps it exciting. But during like general training is like, we are still super serious and super focused. It's like, I guess we were saying all these guys, they're doing all their effort. I mean, we do all our efforts too. We still hit the set button a million times. We just do it with other people.
I remember you telling me about the heat map, the Strava heat map around Nice, and that you, when you looked at, I think with Joe, maybe you were looking at how you tend to ride the same road. Yeah,
that's one thing. The one thing I've actually definitely tried to incorporate is just like, riding over all different kinds of terrains rather than like when I was younger, I used to be like, oh, I'd go to like certain climbs because I knew I could hit like certain power on that climb. Whereas like now I try to mix it up and do like, different kind of terrain that like doesn't suit me as well, which just means in general you're exploring more. So, I enjoy that. But I think, it's one of these things where, you do have to find like a little bit of balance, and I wouldn't say like I'm not stopping a ton to take photos, and I haven't integrated as much of the spirit of the no-go tour into my daily training as I should, but I definitely think it's something I want to do regularly in terms of like going on adventures like that.
But as you say, Joe, I mean, the reward for that is not perhaps to be found in races. There and especially now, the demands seem more extreme, and the sacrifices required seem more extreme. And I guess it boils down to who's actually prepared to make that commitment and to really be unbalanced, as you say, and in pursuit of your goals. And I mean, maybe you can do that for a limited period of time here, but there are riders who clearly can do it all year round.
Yeah, well, and I think it's also like define extreme. It's like if something becomes normalized to you and it's something that you take pleasure in, then is it extreme?
Does a monk live an extreme lifestyle?
Ask a monk, probably not. That's what I mean. It's like I think you find something you enjoy, and for a lot of cyclists, that very methodical preparation is what they enjoy. So I think for them, it's not extreme, and they may be totally blind to the fact that every normal person around them sort of observes this and they see it as extreme. But like I said, I think even in other sorts of very competitive environments, maybe it's not cycling, maybe it's business. I think you witness that a lot. And people are just absorbed in, what they're doing. An example I would draw is like, Berkshire Hathaway, like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. I think Buffett's 89 and Munger is 95, and they both go to work every day. And what's Buffett worth? Like $100 billion? It's like, he certainly doesn't need to work. I think he lives a pretty simple lifestyle, but I imagine he just loves doing what he does. And I think for a lot of cyclists, they're in that position, which actually I think is...
And you'll not be doing it in your 80s.
What's that?
You'll not be doing it in your 80s.
Well, but you're doing it because you love it, And I think it's a beautiful thing. I got in an argument with my dad once about who had a better job. He's an aerospace engineer. And I'm like, well, your job's not that good. And finally it came to the point where I was like, well, okay, we're both going to get paid our current salary for the rest of our lives. You don't have to show up to work tomorrow. Are you going to go to work? And I was like, because I'm going to go ride my bike tomorrow. And I'm probably going to ride long and ride hard because it's just what I feel like doing. And he was like, well, no, I'm going to stay home. And it's
you won the argument.
Yeah.
Do you guys, is there a point in your career where you feel secure? I mean, it's not a secure sport, but do you reach a point where, because I guess when when I saw you 3.5 years ago here, you're still kind of, in a way, proving yourselves and trying to fulfill your potential. Do you feel now more secure? Not necessarily because you've got long contracts or whatever, but just that you've found your place and that there's a security that comes with that.
I feel like none of us have really like gotten to the place where we feel like we've actually reached our potential, consistently. Like maybe we've all seen glimpses of it, but I think until you're like consistently riding at your potential, you never feel like that sort of security, And I mean, if you just even think, if you look at some other riders, there have been other riders in the past who've won Grand Tours and a couple of years later, I mean, who knows why they won those Grand Tours and stuff. But I'm just saying, for example, these guys have reached the pinnacle of the sport, and in the end, they end up on tiny teams.
Sometimes I think if you feel secure, you're on the way out.
So you need to be writing every day, like, you know, every day matters. And
yes.
You're always writing for your next contract.
I think so, yes. Because a rider's value to a team and what team's perception of that rider is, I think, can drop precipitously very quickly.
But also increase at the same time.
Also increase very quickly. But as to say, I don't think you can ever sort of rest on your laurels, so to speak.
Mm. Well, I think it also depends on how you define security. Is that like financial security or longevity? For example, I was texting G on stage 18 when the tour was, the stage that got shortened halfway, or, you know, just before the final climb. And he responded to me, which was a big surprise. But like, is he secure in his career? You know, like financially he's secure. He's got a 4-year deal with Ineos. But like, he probably doesn't feel secure because he wants to win the tour again. And so how do you...
Yeah, you know, it's a good... Everybody is kind of shitting themselves. You know, yeah. They're all... they all feel... I mean, that's the thing that's driving everybody, isn't it? The feel that they need to prove yourself, and that's an ongoing. You never actually reach that point, I guess.
I think there's very few cyclists in the pro peloton this day and age that sign a long contract and are feel secure, like they're just going to kick their feet up for a couple of years and take it easy. I think there's like stories in the past of riders doing that, but I don't think that exists anymore. I mean, riders are racing today because they want to perform in every race and throughout the season, and you know, season on season. They're not doing it just to, you know, find some sort of financial security or career security.
How do you feel, Ian? I mean, having sort of made the decision to step out of this world, is that...
Before we say step out, I feel like it's more of like a transition than
a retirement.
Not a retirement. Yeah. I know it seems a very, especially for someone still so young, to use the word retirement, but is there a sense of relief that comes with that? Or, you know, is there a weight off because of what we're just talking about, that the pressure is always there to prove yourself?
There is almost a sense of security. I was out riding today and came across Phil Deignan, and we were both on an hour and a half ride. And the perspective of, cool, we have an hour and a half free to go ride, has completely changed. You know, I mean, when you're training, there's days you want to train, there's days you don't want to train. But the perspective of now, like, I have an hour and a half free, I'm going to go ride for fun, has really changed. And to realize like how fortunate we are to have that time to ride a bike. And I think we all enjoy riding on a nice sunny day, but there's plenty of days you don't enjoy riding. But to realize how awesome it is, and especially, you know, we've all been in Nice for almost, I guess, Joe and I for 7 years, Larry for 5. But how amazing of a place it is to ride a bike. And you... I don't think you can really fully appreciate it until you like take a step back. And like, we went up Col d'Huez today, and it's like, this is unbelievable. Like, looking over the Mediterranean, we're riding our bikes, and for the last 7 years, that's been my job. And for these guys, it's, you know, still their job. And for Will and Matteo, like, trying to, you know, give them a little bit of perspective of like, this is a dream come true. Like, you have to really enjoy this, and obviously work hard, but, like, you know, every once in a while, maybe do stop and take a picture because it's not going to last forever.
What will you miss most about it?
About living in Nice?
About
and
being a professional cyclist. I mean, you're still going to be a cyclist, but, you know, what will you miss most about being a professional rider on a World Tour team?
I think I'll miss most... I mean, there's very few days when, like, you actually have just, like, a magical day. And I think it's that... those days, whether it's training or racing, when everything is just perfect and everything is... you know, everything goes well and you come back. And I think that's one thing I realized in taking a step back, is that a lot of your happiness in cycling depends on how you feel. And I think I'll miss those extreme highs. I mean, you have, you know, lows as well, but just those days when everything's perfect, when you have a good training ride or a good race. And yeah, that's something that I think we constantly, which keeps us all moving forward, is that desire to have that feeling.
Does it change your relationship with your body as well? Because your body is the tool that you're using. And you had a beer at lunch. You know,
I did.
You know, just that kind of slight letting go. Is that something that you are conscious of and are trying to sort of enjoy a bit?
You know, I was speaking with Larry about this because, you know, obviously we speak about nutrition because that's part of cycling, and, you know, more so now than maybe it was in the past. And it's interesting to see how letting go a little bit has actually, like, allowed my body to be more balanced, you know, and how, like, I mean, I think Larry and I, Joe less so, like, we have extreme or have had extreme off seasons where it's like you almost like you binge and then you're like, all right, now I got to get ready for the season. You have to get extremely focused again.
Not almost.
And taking a step back and just realizing that, like, a balanced and healthy life is something that I'll always crave, and having felt that extreme level of health, almost fitness beyond health, where you're, you know, your body's so efficient. It's a feeling that I think most people never experience. And so that the desire to feel healthy is, you know, something I'll always desire.
Do you think that you will miss, because this is what I think I'll miss, so I'm curious as to whether you think you'll miss this. Do you think that you'll miss chasing something, like the competitive, like, aspect, like really, like, progressing, like you won or you lost, you know, that sort of?
I think, yeah, I mean, and I explained to Richard, so I'm going to be participating in gravel events. So there still is competition. And sure. I think, you know, we all very much enjoy the process of getting fit. And, you know, so already I'm, you know, I have, you know, a trip back to Vermont, and then I'm actually going somewhere for Christmas. And then mentally I've already put it in my mind, like, all right, January 1st, I'm starting to, you know, train for 2020 for the gravel events. But no, I think I'll always try to set some sort of goal, whether it's, you know, personal or, you know, a group event. But I think that's something that all of us probably always have aspirations to keep riding our bike at some sort of level, whether it's, you know, even just setting a time up a local climb.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Lacca, bicycle insurance powered by you. Lacca is a community of cyclists all playing fair to insure their bikes and save each other money. If you want to find out more, go to lacca.co.uk, but don't take our word for it. Let's hear from one of Lacca's customers, Chris O'Hearn.
My recent experience with Lacca was I was on a cycling holiday in the Basque Country, having a great time, and unfortunately had a bit of a crash on the descent, and did my collarbone. Lacca couldn't do anything about that, but also did a bit of damage to the bike, and got back and needed a few things done to some repairs to the bike, and Lacca sorted out really quickly. It was amazing. I got back and first thing I saw was my doctor, and then I went to the bike shop and got a crash report just to check that everything was okay. They said there are a few bits that needed to be fixed, including some odd damage to the chainring. Don't quite know how I did that. Put in the crash report to Lacca, and within 3 hours had a call from the bike shop to say Lacca had called them and sorted out the claim and come back and get it all sorted. It was amazing. I mean, I got online, spoke to the guys at Lacca immediately, sent in all the stuff that I needed to do. They processed it really quickly, and within a matter of hours, they'd sorted it out with the bike shop.
So if that sounds like the perfect way to cover your bikes and equipment, go to lacca.co.uk. That's lacca.co.uk.
So what are you guys chasing next year? What are you chasing, Joe? The Giro again? I mean, you rode a very good Giro this year.
Yeah, I think from what I've heard from the team, the Giro's the objective. I don't know too much beyond that.
I mean, for me, I'm struggling to believe that you're going to be on a team with a guy that looks younger than you, Pogacar.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? Know.
It's ridiculous.
To have a great Giro would be, you know, good. I think improve on my Giro from last year.
What would that look like, a good Giro?
Winning stages is always great. If I can do a good GC too, that would be great. You know, top 10, who knows?
You weren't that far off top 10 this year, were you?
No, I think I was 12th.
12th.
So,
pretty
close.
Know,
maybe you can...
You think or you know?
I mean,
no. I was. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, if you can do like a nice top 10, 6th, 7th, I don't know. That's a good ride.
We used to have a phrase a la Zubeldia, you know, for ghosting into the top 10.
Yeah, but he didn't ghost.
I was in the breakaway a few
you
days.
You were, you know, but we could, a la Dombrowski could be the new,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
If you can ghost your way. No, you were quite visible at the Giro.
Yeah.
I mean, you and Hugh Carthy.
I don't think you want to do it in a way of like never taking a day in the breakaway to finish 10th.
No.
I think you should...
Although you'd probably take that.
You'd take that, but I think it's worth gambling a bit. Because here's the thing, is like when you get to week two or three and you're in these stages with multiple long climbs, it's not really any more costly to be in the breakaway. Okay, maybe it's a little bit, but not much. And it's like what you have to gain, one, in the chance to win a stage, which I always think a stage win is bigger than a top 10 unless you're in the top five, is sort of what I think. And if you are chasing the GC and you're in that like 7th through 12th sort of zone, they don't really care if you move up 4 minutes. So it can also benefit you there. Mm. You know, like the guys that are willing to put an entire team on the front to ride are the guys that are going to win a Grand Tour. And that's like three guys. So.
Actually, thinking of the Giro this year, I interviewed Larry on the... why are you laughing? Was it a funny interview? I remember I interviewed on the morning of one stage. And basically I was asking you about...
Oh, I remember this now because couldn't get into the VIP.
That's right.
Area.
You had to let me in. You had to pull a few strings. Yeah. But the point of the interview was that AG2 hadn't won a stage at the Giro for like 10 years or something. And then that day they did win a stage.
That so was the day that Nans
won? Yeah, it was the day. Yeah, yeah.
Impressive. Maybe they should just renounce the Giro Direct Energy.
That was almost inevitable that having done that interview, AG2 would win a stage. But what for you? I mean, what are you chasing next year?
I think really like my goal is to really try to find a consistent level. If I can consistently be at the level I was at the end of last season for the whole season, I'd be really happy. But yeah, I think it's looking like I'll probably do the Giro with Ramon. And should I do that, I'd like to really be the best helper I can be. And if... to put that into, you know, I guess concrete words would be, you know, if I can be there when there's like 20 guys left, if I can really be one of the last guys with him in the mountains and, you know, on the hilly days and stuff like that. So if I can just really be an asset to him, that would be really big for me. And yeah, then just to really reach that level of like an excellent domestique for a good leader would just be really cool for me. I think that'd be a nice progression to see in my career. And then aside from that is I'd like to win a race next year. I don't really care what race it is.
The Tour de France.
Yeah. Yeah. Joe did have a dream that I was on the podium of the Tour de France, which great dream.
I sent him a text the next morning.
I wish I had that dream, but yeah, only Joe.
The rest of the dream was he was on the podium. He was third. And Lavenue came up in tears and took the microphone in Paris and said, "I just wanted to make America great again."
So Joe's dreams are bigger than my goals, but I hope that happens one day. Probably not this year.
Make America great again. You wear a hat and everything. Yeah, I mean, what? I mean, I asked you earlier about the team, but what has it? You've been on very sort of international teams before. How has it been being on a, you know, quite unusual not being a Frenchman on that team? What's that felt like? Is it culturally very different?
Yeah, it is. The thing is actually, I would say in general, like quite familial because I had like an interview recently and they were asking me about this and it's like, you know, there isn't really a lot of turnover in the team, so most of the staff's been there forever, and a lot of riders have been there a really long time, so it is like a pretty tight-knit bunch. And you know, one thing that everyone says is that like Vincent, he's super loyal, and I think you see that within the team. And I think it's pretty cool because, you know, relatively for the team's budget and everything, they perform quite well. You know, always decent, and you know, they're never like at the bottom of the ranking or anything, and they don't have a gigantic budget. So yeah, I think it's a nice place to be. Just because there's really not like a ton of pressure or stress, but everyone's pretty serious and motivated and works hard. So, and I think maybe part of that comes from Roman, because like he works his ass off and he's one of the hardest workers. And I think everyone sees that, and you know, he kind of raises their level. So
I just remembered you had a little debate on Twitter recently with Jonathan Waters about the whole.
I tried to not engage in a debate.
You diffused it quite well. You diffused it quite well.
Well, I don't think it was diffused, but I don't want to participate.
There goes the contract with
the F. Possible.
But your argument was about that, you know, the advantages was of a sort of a home team in a way of creating a culture which supports. Well, the argument you were making was for American writers.
Yeah, I was just, you know, I think the thing is you see, there's a lot of huge talent coming that comes out of the U.S. And sort of the question was, because, you know, there's so many good young Americans, whatever, like, you know, am I excited for the future? But, you know, I think the one thing we have to remember is that, like, you know, for example, like Joe here, Joe was the most highly touted under 23 writer in the world, you know? So,
and look how shitty he is now.
No, but it's just like, it's not like we haven't had great under 23s before, you know? TJ, Talansky, Ian was also very good. You know, it's like, I just think that, like, Taylor Finney, you know, I think, like, there's this somewhere we're losing, like, the transition from best under 23 to best pro isn't like happening as much for us in the US, and like I don't know what that is. And I was just sort of musing, I'm not sure if it's the answer, but I was thinking, like, you know, if we, for example, had the American equivalent of Sky, maybe we would see these kids turning out to be the best pros.
Larry, you know, and I decided the other day that we're starting an American World Tour team.
Yeah. So it might
have space.
This is the thing. It was like, well, you know, I'm not saying anyone else has to do it. I'm saying maybe we're going to have to start it ourselves one day. And, you know, the one thing Jonathan said was just that, like, oh, you know, he builds his team based on merit. And I definitely wasn't saying it shouldn't be on merit, because, like, if you're taking the best under 23s in the world who happen to be American, they merit, you know, they deserve to be on a World Tour team. So, yeah, it's just, you know, I think the thing is like, when you go to these big teams, it's easy to get lost. And when you come over to Europe, you know, it's like we all just kind of flew into the deep end and figured it out ourselves, you know. But if you had someone really, like, giving you the structure, showing you the way, holding your hand, like, you know, getting your visa, doing this, finding an apartment, all that, it's like it would make your life a whole lot easier and it'd be a lot easier to perform. And then, you know, things after that, I think, would progress well. I mean, yeah, who knows? Maybe it wouldn't work, but...
I mean, but would you... is that a serious... Would you like to run a team?
I would.
Sometimes I think that would be a fun thing to do, and then sometimes I think, like, cycling is so... It's such a mess that, like, from a... Just top-down how it's organized and all the different... I think the big problem with cycling is all the different interests, like the UCI, the riders, the teams, the organizers of the various races all have their own interests, and I just don't know that that's ever going to change. And I think if that doesn't change, it's going to be the same thing over and over. And it's like I said, I don't think that you can, if you feel comfortable and if you feel what was the word we used before? Secure. I don't think you're going to...
It's the same, I guess. Yeah.
I think for a team manager, it's like that even more. And I'm sort of like, it might be cool, but it might be an even more stressed out version of being a rider with a lot more admin and a lot less riding your bike every day.
Ian, the question that Joe asked you about, will you miss chasing something? I mean, turning that around... I mentioned to you earlier the Andy Murray documentary on Amazon, which is amazing, and it's a really great insight. But objectively, when you look at him and him, you know, trying everything to still be able to compete, it's mad. You know, it's crazy. It's insane. And I guess I don't know if, having sort of stepped out even briefly, there's a part of you that looks at their world and the world that you were in and thinks it is kind of crazy. The chasing is crazy in a way as well, yeah. As much as it can be simulating and fun.
It's completely crazy.
Is that something you've kind of thought?
Well, I mean, I guess I have a unique perspective in the fact that I really admire it. And like, I mean, it's not that long ago I was racing. I'm still under contract with Katusha for another couple of weeks.
Still got a check to get?
Hopefully. I'm sending my bikes back tomorrow. But I know that mindset. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I did intervals with Larry 2 days ago. And just like the fact of how like regimented it is, like he had 6 minutes recovery and it wasn't like, oh, it could be like 6.5 minutes. It was like 6 minutes we're turning around and going straight back up. And the other day I was coming down from our house on Cold Ez and Kreuzwick was coming up doing an interval and I knew exactly what he was doing. Like he was looking at his power meter. He just started an interval. It's, you know, 300 meters into the climb. And there was a garbage truck doing like a 3-point turn because it's a tight switchback. And, you know, I was like, you know, in my car, I'm like, okay, like this truck is, you can see it's clearly about to back up. You know, I'm like in my car, so I'm more patient than he is. And like literally this truck almost backs into him, like pins him between him and a wall. And he threw his hand up. He was pissed at the garbage truck. Because when you're in that space of, I'm doing an interval, I'm training for the Tour de France, this is the most important thing in the world. And this garbage guy, like, what is he doing trying to do a 3-point turn? And that perspective has changed really quickly to see, because you know, I've been there. I've been the exact same. Like, I'm into my effort. I'm going to, you know, go around all these cars, go through the red light, because I need to keep doing this 10-minute effort. And you don't have this perspective of, like, if I stop for, like, you know, 30 seconds and keep going, is it really going to change, you know, my training session? But that focus is something that, for me, has really quickly, the perspective of, like, what you're actually doing and the consequences of, you know, changing something very slightly, in my perspective now, aren't that great. But in the moment, you don't see that.
That's interesting. And Kreuzwick, I think, is a guy who's dialed, you know, and really follows everything to the letter. But yeah, I can imagine the inconvenience of the garbage truck. Yeah,
I would do the same thing as Kreuzwick, for sure.
And that's the thing. Coming back here now and seeing all these riders, you know, kind of get back into their season and, you know, kind of, you know, turning that switch on again. I've done that, so I know what it's like. But taking a step, like just being, you know, one step removed, realizing like how much of these small, the small things do add up. But there are definitely things that these two do that I did that aren't always necessary. But mentally, you rationalize it to make it, you know, you justify it because that's what, that's your focus in life and that's your objective. So you do it.
I think the thing is also there's a few of these things where like maybe you know they don't make the most gigantic difference, but in your head doing them makes you feel more comfortable and secure.
It's more for the mental checklist,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, so for example, this evening, Mateo was going to the gym and the gym's maybe like 800 meters from our house down the hill. And he came and he went out to take, I sold him my car and he didn't want to take the car because it's not insured right now. So he asked Will if he could give him a ride on the scooter.
You can't walk 800 meters.
So this is the point. Like I would have, we've all probably done the same thing. Like, you know, been a tired cyclist. But when I thought about it, I was like, wait, you're trying to save energy to go work out. Like, you know, it's like, you know, like,
I would have definitely walked.
I mean, you could walk. It's like a warm up. You know, he's going to go to the gym and like jump on an elliptical for 10 minutes to warm up before he lifts weights.
I'm
like,
what does he do in the
you
gym?
You could have just walked. But, you know, so in a sense, I'm like poking fun at him. But at the same time, I also understand the mindset of like, you know, this conservation of energy.
Sort of necessary, isn't it, as well, in a way, just to feel, again, like you're, it's for that, to feel a bit of security that you're ticking all the boxes. And
yeah. Well, I think cyclists are also masters of economy of effort in all sorts of things. And it comes across as being very lazy, sweatpant wearing slobs.
Sometimes I say, like, the more worthless human being I am, the better cyclist I am, which is maybe a bad thing to say, but, you know.
For example, I walked here tonight to dinner, and it took me maybe 20 minutes, and we've come to restaurants in this area for 7 years, and I've never walked. You know, like, it's not...
And you and me can get a second bottle of wine.
Yeah,
as well,
yeah, I'm going to have to drive home.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and their support of you in your endeavours. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport sports nutrition products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com, and thanks once again to them for their support. Hope you enjoyed hearing again from Larry Warbass, Joe Dombrowski and Ian Boswell. And as I said at the start, we'll hear more from Boswell early in the new year. Now let's hear from the latest young Americans to make Nice their home. 23-year-old Will Barta, who rides for CCC, and 20-year-old Matteo Jorgensen, who will ride for Movistar next year. First season World Tour. Did I see you yesterday out riding with full CCC kit but a blue top?
No, actually, I'm some fan, I guess, because I actually took yesterday off, so... Yeah, so not, maybe I should say it's me so I seem dedicated, but no, it was someone else, yeah.
Don't want to get in trouble for not wearing team kit. Yeah. But how has this season been? I saw you at the Vuelta. I mean, first of all, your first Grand Tour. How did you find that, and how do you feel? I mean, a lot of riders say that a Grand Tour sort of changes you, you know, finishing the race. It's maybe too early to tell, but how did you feel getting through that race?
Yeah, I think it's obviously, it's, you know, a Grand Tour or something you kind of dream about when you're young, and to finish it was it felt like a big achievement and also a big relief to get through it. There was a lot of times, I mean, there wasn't so many times in the race I actually felt really on the limit. I think going forward I would like to maybe look at it more as a, you know, take it day by day, but at that time I was so focused on just, you know, getting through it, to be honest. So but I mean, yeah, I didn't race anymore after that in the year, so I can't really tell you if it's changed me. This year it seems like my fitness has come back a bit quicker when I've been training, so I'm hoping it's a good sign for the next year.
Any dark moments in the Vuelta, because it's a long time, 3 weeks?
Well, there was the, you know, the stage, Gilbert one, where it was the fastest stage. Yeah, I was in a group with about 140k to go, and we were clear we were not coming back, so that was a bit, you know, worrying, because but we were all in it together. And then also that second to last stage, I was definitely feeling the 3 weeks that day, so, but then you're so close, you see the end.
I mean, a lot of people said afterwards that was one of the hardest Grand Tours, and I think Roglic's numbers suggested that it was a really hard race. I think the Vuelta, because it, the nature of the course, you know, it's just pretty intense every day.
Yeah.
Is that encouraging that it wasn't an easy Grand Tour, that you know, that it was a hard physical test for everybody?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, from all the older guys you hear, all the Vuelta is like the easy way to start, you know, but yeah, I mean, I would say there weren't so many days that you really were, you know, fighting for it, but there was never an easy day is what I really noticed. And I think for 3 weeks, I mean, I can't tell you from any other Grand Tours, but I found that to be challenging. But to hear from everybody that's, you know, pretty much as hard as it gets, it's a nice sign for the next races.
Matteo, nice to meet you.
Yeah, I
mean, I've been reading a bit about you and how you've kind of earned yourself this contract. Tell me about your approach to coming to Europe. And I read in Velo News that you sent emails out to teams that you wrote, even if you didn't speak the languages, you tried to communicate with teams in their own language. When did that process start?
Yeah, I think it started when I was a junior. When I was 15 or 16, I came to Europe with the national team, and when I was racing those kermesses, I think, like, just living over in Belgium or in the Netherlands and being in Europe and experiencing the racing, it felt a lot more real than racing in the U.S. did, and I think it had a big impact on me the junior years in Europe. So as soon as I got through those, I think my first year, 23, going into my first year, 23, I made a big effort to try to come to Europe, but it just didn't come together, and I still spent a lot of time with the national team in Europe that spring, so I kind of always knew that I needed to be in Europe if I wanted to make it in cycling.
And so you began contacting teams. You were quite proactive about it. What age were you then, and what sort of response did you get?
Yeah, I was a second year junior, so 18. And I got some, I got mixed responses. Like, I mean, mostly pretty much like I was an unknown prospect at the time. I mean, I didn't really have any big results. I had done pretty limited racing in Europe, like two stage races a year, and some kermesses. And so teams, it's a big opportunity that they have to give you, and a big jump for them to allow you to come, like, fly all the way over. It's a bigger commitment for them, for an American versus a guy in Europe, because, yeah, I don't speak many of the languages that a lot of, like, my teammates this year do, and so it's just a bigger time and money commitment for them, so it's understandable that they would have apprehension towards bringing on an American. And yeah, my first year before I was proven at all in Europe, it was definitely difficult to get into a conversation even with a lot of the teams.
So what happened then? Because you came last year and you were with the AG2R development setup, but how did that come about?
Yeah, my first year in the 23 with the national team, I had a top 10 at a race in France, in Rhône-Alpes, and it's kind of like the home region of Chambéry, the team I was with this year, and they were at the race. Actually, like, the manager of the team has directed the race tons and tons of times, and he really, like, thinks it's a, I mean, I agree with him, I think it's a really, like, it's a race that proves riders, and so yeah, I had a decent ride when I was a first year under 23 that showed some promise, and he kind of saw that, I mean, if you can do well at that race, maybe you have some potential to do well.
And I guess a lot of people would have imagined you would turn pro with AG2R, but you're turning pro with Movistar. First American on that team since Andy Hampson. You're probably too young to remember Andy Hampson, but I remember him very well. But how did that come about? Because it's quite a surprising move. Was there a possibility of joining AG2R, or was the Movistar option a more attractive one?
Yeah, for sure. It was a bit of a complicated decision in that AG2R and my team Chambéry have a really they have a very conservative approach to turning riders pro, and they really believe in the under 23 development system, which is, I mean, I agree with them, it's a super valuable system, and so they kind of always wait to turn riders pro, even when, you know, it's clear, like, for a lot of guys, like, for example, Clément Champoussin, I would say last year he was ready to turn pro, but he's still waited like another year and or 2 years, and that's just kind of the way they do things on that team, and I think it's worked for a lot of time for them. However, I think in the last maybe 5 years, we've seen a lot of World Tour teams turn to the youth and start bringing on younger and younger guys, and I think it's proven to be pretty positive for a lot of guys. I mean, obviously there's top guys, but I think there's also a lot of guys that maybe we don't see as much that are thriving. I can see being super young in World Tour teams, and for me, I felt ready, and I think that's really all that you need is to feel ready, and I mean, we'll see what happens, but I wanted to turn pro, so I decided to just go for it.
Well, I mean, I met you here 3.5 years ago, I think. You've been here quite a long time. I mean, I guess you took a different approach. You did come through a development, mm-hmm. I mean, a good development program,
yeah.
And turned pro this year, finally, I guess. Mm-hmm. You're still very young, though.
Yeah.
Did it feel like you were serving a long apprenticeship before that? And how important was it for you being here in Nice with the guys I met you with the last time, Joe, Larry, Ian? Have you learned a lot from those guys?
Yeah, I think, first going to the question with development, I spent all 4 years under 23, and to be honest, I'm quite happy I did. On action, you know, you're quite well taken care of, to be honest, and so you really have the possibility. I mean, yeah, it's not like you're, you know, a baller, you know, but you can live on what you make, and so, I really appreciate it because, you know, the first year I really raced with the national team, not much with action, and then the second year, you know, I really felt like I was trying to learn how to, you know, really be a good teammate, And the next 2 years I went for results more myself, but I really liked the step of, you know, each role you're trying to learn. And so, because obviously, I mean, most people when they go pro, they're hoping. So it's I think it's important to learn that role and be confident in yourself doing that job as well. So I was really happy to spend all 4 years. And I mean, it was, I think the memories from Action will be some of the best memories of my life. So to get as much of that as I can is obviously a great thing. And then, with learning from Ian and Joe and Larry, I think, you know, each of them has their own personality. And so it's really nice to see like what works and for some people doesn't work for other people. And just to see how much you have to have kind of an individualistic approach to what you're doing. And also I think like one of the biggest things I've learned is, you know, I think when I was under 23, especially, you know, you're so focused on, you know, every single detail, which is really, really good. But I think it's easy to get hung up on those details. And when you have these guys who have been doing it for, you know, 5-6 years, you see, I mean, they do their job incredibly well and they are really professional about what they're doing, but they also realize there's life and things happen. And I mean, all you can do is your best and have to be happy with that. So I really think that was a great thing to learn from them.
It's really funny because when I first came over, they were the young Americans, yeah, you know? And it's amazing how quickly things change and move on. And all of a sudden they're sort of experienced riders in their late 20s and Ian, you know, on the brink of retirement. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, and then they start to talk differently about the younger guys, you know, and they see a real difference between them and the younger guys and how the sport just changes so quickly, I guess. I mean, even in your time here, you must have seen changes.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I think Matteo and I are both of the generation where, I mean, even when you're juniors, you're training on power. And so for us, it's totally normal to, you know, you go out, you do these intervals at this power. And I think, you know, someone like Ian, and I really admire it too, is just a different way of doing it. He likes, you know, he's more someone that, you know, goes on feel and kind of, and it's just been, you know, it's interesting just to see the different methodologies.
And in a group as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because now, you know, everyone has their program that they're supposed to do. And to be honest, most of the days with mine that I'm given, it's really difficult to go with a group. So it's, at the same time, you know, when I was younger, a bit younger, I thought always, you know, I'll have to do exactly, you know, what I have to do. And I think it's really important to do that. But I also think, you know, to stay fresh through the season, it is important to have the social aspect of riding and just enjoy it sometimes. So that's also been another thing I've learned from them. And but yeah, no, it's definitely changed cycling.
This week's podcast has been a little different to the usual fare, but I always enjoy hearing from Joe Dombrowski, Larry Warbass and Ian Boswell, and on this occasion, Matteo Jorgensen and Will Barta as well. I hope you enjoyed it too. Over the winter, there will be other weeks when we put out something a little bit different, so listen out for some unusual off-season episodes. Just before we go this week, a reminder that we've launched our Friends programme for 2020, and let's hear a clip from the first Friends special, The Stage That Didn't End, all about Stage 19 at this year's Tour de France, and the youngest winner of the Tour in over a century, Egan Bernal. I've never. Hope your cars are strong. That was incredible.
To all the teams, a very important message. Important message. Due to very bad weather conditions that caused a 112 heavy hail, we are forced to stop the stage.
Yeah, I didn't understand what happened at the moment because I was in the downhill already. And I heard something in the radio, but they were talking in English, and I was like really concentrated to do the downhill fast. And then I asked to Nico to explain me what was happening in Spanish, and he explained me, and you know was a little bit strange because I saw the weather and was like a sunny day, and they say that it was raining full gas in a few kilometers after.
I'll tell you what, I'm glad we didn't get this in the helicopter.
I think they might not have let us take off in the first place.
Whoa. And we're watching the race on the in the just over the hill there in perfect weather. You know, there's nothing. Little do they know what awaits them.
Well, listening to the audio, it seems that we're in a bit of a panic, but we're not. Honestly, it was very relaxed. I mean, we took the decisions when we had to take the decisions, but because we had the information well before everyone else.
Dios, sácame adelante. La voz no me puede fallar en un instante tan importante. Dame fuerzas. Egan, campeón. Colombia te ama, Egan. Colombia te ama.
That was a clip from our first Friends special of 2020, and there are more to come in the next couple of weeks. Don't forget, you can sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, and if you sign up as a special friend, you'll get a signed copy of our book, The Grand Tour Diaries, in the post.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.